what you're hearing from Professor Paul Copan, and his talk is entitled Integrated Apologetics, Defending the Gospel in the Marketplace of Ideas. Professor Copan is professor of philosophy and ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida. Sounds like a nice place, especially in the winter, I guess. As well as a prolific writer in the fields of theology, analytic philosophy, and apologetics. He did his doctoral work in philosophy of religion at Marquette University, which is in Milwaukee, a Jesuit school that some of you may have heard of. So we've had lots of talks on different topics this term, you know, as some of you who've been with us on justice, on forgiveness, on Old Testament and biblical cosmology, and I think this is going to be a fantastic addition to that, and so we look forward to hearing from you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, glad to join you here, and it's been nice to have a little bit of a family reunion. With, you know, of course, my wife and I have been here since January, and we've had a couple of our sons join us from the United States last week, and then our daughter Johanna and her husband Estienne from Paris have come, and they've spent a nice long weekend with us. So it's been a great delight to share in the joys of Oxford, and this again being in a place like this. I mean, you can't really get any more, you know, classic Oxford than meeting in a pub of this nature. So it's really a great delight. Just a we like to go around and touch the beams and take in the history wherever we go. So it's been great to be here at Oxford. Well, I'm speaking on the topic of apologetics. I don't know what your thoughts are on apologetics. I'm going to, you know, maybe some of you are a little skeptical about apologetics. You think maybe it doesn't really have a place in the church. I'll talk a little bit about that. I do touch on that in both books. You know, the Little Book for New Philosophers, which is actually written to persuade people that philosophy and also, incidentally, apologetics do have a place to be affirmed within the church and also as a great resource for the church. In fact, theology has actually been shaped by a philosophical vocabulary. That if you know one Princeton philosopher who taught seminarians a class on theology, you know, and philosophy, he said basically every major Christian doctrine has a philosophical cast to it. And if you're going to understand theology, you're going to have to understand something of the history of philosophy, you know, Doctrine of the Trinity and so forth. So there is a place for this. And so I want to get into talking about apologetics. And in doing so, wanted to unpack, first of all, the meaning of apologetics, and then look at some misunderstandings about apologetics and some muddles in apologetics and the methodology of apologetics. Now, I'm not really strict on the methodology. Basically, some of the important areas that I think are important to incorporate as we defend the gospel in the marketplace of ideas. So let's begin by talking about the meaning of apologetics, and I find this helpful. It's the art and science of defending the Christian faith. A lot of people go into apologetics thinking that it's beating people up for Jesus, it's winning debates and so forth, and it really, you know, I mean, the debate and so forth, argumentation in the more classical sense, that's important. But I think it's, you know, how we go about doing it is going to be just as important as well. So, apologetics as an art. What do we mean by apologetics as an art? Well, there's the dialogical factor, that apologetics is conversational more than it is confrontational. A good friend of mine, William Lane Craig, he engages in debates, and there is something of a confrontation there. But as we engage in defending the Christian faith, it should be done in a winsome and wise way, not losing the person for the sake of winning the argument. And this also means being a good question asker, just as Jesus was. So that's one thing that we also want to encourage. You know, how do you, when people say, I guess I can go back here, when people are insisting on, say, well, telling you to prove your point or to prove that God exists or something like that. It might just be good to stop and ask, well, what exactly do you mean by prove? What do people, you know, a lot of people will, and we'll see this a little bit later, they'll assume that the Christian has a really high bar to cross or before he can actually make his case. And typically, there's a double standard because those who hold to the beliefs that they do when they challenge the Christian don't have that high a bar for their threshold for what they believe. And so it's good to gently ask back. One time there was speaking at Union College in Schenectady, New York, and there was one student who came up to me after I was speaking to the debating society there, and he said, prove to me that God exists. And I said, well, what would you take as an acceptable level of proof? And he said, you know, I haven't really even thought about it. But people just throw that out, and then it's just good to help them to backtrack a little bit and to probe and ask them to maybe re-examine their assumptions, re-examine what they mean by a certain term that they're using. So asking those questions, there's a dialogical factor. The relational factor is also going to be important, that apologetics involves personal relationship. I think so often we can engage in apologetics in a very detached sort of a way, and it's going to require wisdom as we engage in apologetics. It's not merely giving information to people. So it's going to mean being a loving witness. It's going to be mean having tact as we engage with others. It's going to also involve more than just the one Christian. It's going to involve the Christian community to be a loving witness that there are other people who also share these convictions and can also articulate and defend them. If you're interested in a fine book on, I guess this is kind of more like both the relational and the dialogical, it's a book called Questioning Evangelism by Randy Newman. And it basically tries to examine, and it does, I think it does a fine job, examines the approach that Jesus took as he would push back gently, or sometimes a bit more forcefully, when he would challenge people who are challenging him, asking him questions. And he would often respond to a question with a question. So it's going to require wisdom, it's going to require creativity and thoughtfulness, but there's a certain art to engaging in apologetics. Another point that is worth considering is this, the motivational factor. That as we look at apologetics as an art of defending the Christian faith, there's also the fact that people may be resistant to arguments for deeper reasons. There's often a question behind the question that people have. So when people are, a lot of times there's the anger quotient. When I'm speaking with people and I sense that they are angry, that there's a certain hostility, that there's a chip on the shoulder, I realize that an argument is going to be probably less helpful than just maybe finding out a little bit about where this person is coming from. That there is probably this person hasn't been reasoned into his atheism in all likelihood. That there's probably a certain psychological disposition that needs to be addressed rather than merely piling on arguments for God's existence or whatever. So Paul Vitz, for example, has written a book called Faith of the Fatherless, in which he looks at the various atheists in Western history. Think of your Hall of Fame or your Hall of Faithlessness, where you have those like Sartre and to an extent Hume, and all the way to Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so forth in our more recent times. That virtually to a person, these atheists or skeptics have had a negative or non-existent relationship with their fathers, a very interesting factor. Now, does this prove that atheism is false? No, not at all. That would be to commit the genetic fallacy. But it does remind us that there may be some underlying psychological factors, family issues, and so forth, that may actually be a barrier to communicating with someone, talking about reasons for God's existence and so forth. The reasons often run far deeper. And so that's what we need to be considering here as we look at an apologetics as the art of defending the Christian faith. What is maybe their disposition? What's behind maybe some of that hostility? There's also the existential factor. And a very good book on this is the Existential Reasons for Belief in God. That there needs to be a greater holism, I think, in our presentation of the defense of the gospel. So often we think, oh, I'm going to give rational arguments, but there are also existential reasons for considering the gospel. That the gospel has come to address us, people who have guilt and shame, people who have great longings. I mean, C.S. Lewis talked about the this argument, he gave this argument from desire, that we have this deep longing of something we've never experienced. We're looking for something more than what we've just experienced. What is that longing? Of course, Ecclesiastes talks about that God has set eternity in our hearts. And so it's the issues of the fear of death, the longing for immortality, the quest for significance and security. All of these are also part of the gospel message, the broader defense of the gospel. And so we ought to include this as we speak to people, not simply giving to them a number of excellent reasons that may not really connect with them, because there is a perhaps a deeper level that can penetrate, a deeper matter that can penetrate some of these issues of the heart. And so existential reasons are also going to be important. Blaise Pascal talked about the nature of God, who is willing to appear openly to those who seek him with all their heart, and to be hidden from those who flee from him with all their heart. There is enough light for those who only desire to see, and enough obscurity for those who have a contrary disposition. If you're looking for a way to get out from under belief in God, you can find those excuses. If you're looking for reasons, they're out there, they're available. And I think we need to make sure that we present it in such a way that that takes into consideration that people may not want to pursue the light, that people do love darkness rather than light, and there may be other ways of kind of going around some of their maybe intellectual or rational objections to what C.S. Lewis called those sleeping dragons. Sometimes catching them unawares by maybe telling a story, by weaving together a narrative or a parable, just like Nathan did when he was confronting David. And so he told the story about the man and the sheep and the rich man who took that sheep. And then Nathan says, "You are the man," to David. Now, what about apologetics as a science? Well, here we have something that perhaps we more commonly associate with apologetics, that the biblical faith is a knowledge tradition, that we can truly know when it comes to God's revelation, both in nature as well as in Scripture. That Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 that Christ has not been raised from the dead. If this is not a historical fact, then there is no Christian faith. Paul was very much a realist. He was not an anti-realist saying, "I don't care what the facts say, I'm just going to believe this." Or, "You ask me how I know he lives within my heart," as though that was the only reason one can give for the resurrection. No, it has to be anchored in historical fact, in historical reality. So we can truly know. Also, we're talking about public knowledge. We're talking about what is publicly accessible, that people can explore the Christian faith for themselves. It's not as though God has somehow whispered into my ear and no one else can get in on the secret. No, it's publicly scrutinizable, if you will. And then it's also rational, that there are reasons that we can give for believing in Christ. A lot of times I'll talk about the Big Bang. I'll just connect that to sounding very similar to Genesis 1:1, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," that we have very good scientific reason for taking that seriously, that maybe this is an indicator of a transcendent realm that they should be considering, and of course the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. C.S. Lewis, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." And I like Alvin Plantinga's quotation about theism, that offers suggestions for answers to a wide range of otherwise intractable questions. That the Christian faith makes sense, that the Christian faith helps to expand our horizons. It is, as Augustine and Anselm said, it's a faith seeking understanding, and also, "I believe in order that I may understand." And so as we through our understanding of the gospel, we see we're actually widening our horizons. We're actually expanding. We're becoming more free thinkers than the atheists who are proclaiming that title for themselves. So that's a bit of the meaning of apologetics. And hopefully you'll see where I'm going on this. This is a much more holistic undertaking. It's much more expansive. It's much more wide-ranging when it comes to who we are as human beings. So some misunderstandings about apologetics. A lot of people will claim that apologetics is anti-biblical. Well, what are some of the reasons people will give? Well, they'll say apologetics is empty philosophy, and Paul speaks against that in Colossians chapter 2. To avoid those empty philosophies of humans. And so that's one text that will often be used. 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, the gospel is foolishness, the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, or the natural man, the natural person doesn't understand the things of the Spirit of God, they're foolishness to him, neither can he know them, for they're spiritually discerned. So, a lot of people will say that if you're trying to engage with people in apologetics, you're presuming kind of a natural way of looking at things, something that is without the Spirit of God. And so that's a verse that is, those are verses that are commonly thrown out to reject apologetics. Here's another one in John chapter 20, where here Thomas has just said that he wouldn't believe unless he could put his fingers into the hands and side of Jesus. And Jesus shows up. And then Jesus tells him, after Thomas has examined him and is convinced, he says, You have believed because you've seen, but blessed are those who haven't seen and still believe. So a lot of people say, look, what's the need for evidence? What's the need for giving a defense? You just have to believe. Or you can't reason people into the kingdom of God. This is an effort of the flesh. This is an effort of humans to try to push forward their arguments, but without reliance on the Spirit of God. So what are we to make of these things? Oh, here's another one. Yeah, sometimes people will even associate apologetics as a work that's added to grace. That, no, we're saved by grace through faith, and so if you're going to start giving apologetics to people, then this really undermines the very work of Christ, the very work of the Spirit. So kind of related to the second last bullet point there. Well, in response, those who appeal to those texts, like 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, to prove that apologetics is unimportant or maybe even misguided or harmful, need to keep reading to the end of the book. As you get to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul lays out the witnesses, those who have seen Jesus, who had been raised from the dead, that Jesus appeared to Cephas, to Peter. He appeared to the 12, or the 11, technically speaking, that Jesus appeared to more than 500 at one time. And he said, most of whom are still alive. You can go ask them. You can check it out with them. And, of course, he appeared to James, who, during Jesus' ministry, did not believe in him. As John 7 says, that even his own brothers did not believe in him. And then, of course, Paul said that he appeared to me as one untimely born, he wasn't an apostle during the time of Jesus, he wasn't one of the disciples during the time of Jesus' ministry, but he did see the risen Jesus and was called to be an apostle, having had that experience, that encounter with Jesus. What about blessed are those who have not seen and yet still believe? Interestingly, the very next verses actually go against what that claim is. Oh, you don't have to give reasons. All you need to do is just believe. Well, the next verses say, therefore many other signs Jesus also performed, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life through his name. In other words, signs and wonders are there to encourage belief, to help people move forward. And interestingly, in John 1, 1 John 1, 1, continuation of sorts, you have John writing, what we have heard, what we have seen, what we have looked at, what we have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, this we proclaim to you. So here, John is not at all going against what has been said earlier in John's gospel. In fact, we see that there is this dovetailing of signs and wonders and also belief, that they're not opposed to one another. So this is something that we see throughout the scriptures. The scriptures are full of signs and wonders to encourage people to believe. Jesus said, if you don't believe in what I say in John chapter 10, at least believe the works that I have performed. So this is not some sort of a blind leap. The Christian faith is something that is objective. There is public scrutiny that is called for. 1 Peter 3:15, a noted verse, people often quote it when they're making their case for the legitimacy of apologetics. And here we have this verse, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being, of course, there's this aspect of the devotional, being committed, first of all, to Christ as Lord. So there's that devotional aspect. And then secondly, there is the intellectual aspect, if you will, of giving a defense, the apologion, giving a defense for the reason for the hope for to anyone who asks you for the reason for what lies this hope that lies within you with gentleness and reverence. So there's that relational component as well. And then the scriptures, as I said before, emphasize not only signs and wonders as public evidence, but they're also emphasizing eyewitnesses. They're also using that term, make a defense. Paul is often in the synagogues dialoguing with people, persuading them of the truth of the scriptures, persuading them that Jesus is the Messiah and so forth. So you see that sort of objectivity that is out there in the scriptures as well, that remind us that apologetics certainly has its place as an important ministry within the church. Here's another argument that is used, that apologetics is somehow anti-faith, that it's somehow opposed to genuine belief. And the problem, however, is when people look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, they're thinking that Paul is opposing reason. But Paul is not opposing reason, he is opposing pride, both on the side of the Greeks as well as the Jews, that there are those who resist the cross because the cross requires a self-humbling. It requires embracing something that is an offense, a stumbling block. That God, stepping into our world, dies naked on a cross. This cross of this curse, this picture of shame and humiliation. And so repentance requires self-humbling. So again, it's not a matter of being irrational or against reason, but really it's a blow to human pride that really is being addressed by Paul in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Mark Twain and Richard Dawkins here come into our second point. There's this false definition that they will give about faith. Mark Twain says, faith is believing what you know ain't so. You've heard that one before. Richard Dawkins says, faith is stubborn belief that is indifferent to evidence and immune to rational criticism. And we've seen that that simply is not the case. As you read the scriptures, you see Jesus saying, at least believe the works that I have done. You see the appeal to eyewitnesses and so forth. Hardly something that flies in the face of evidence. No, in fact, evidence is often being given to persuade people to believe. So we need to remember that faith is something that is a personal appropriation of what one takes to be true. That is not simply a matter of an intellectualized belief, but saying, not there is a God, but you are my God. You are my Lord. I submit to you. And so it is a pledging of allegiance. It is a commitment to Christ, not making a leap that has no regard for evidence, for what is in line with reality. Also, when we talk about this, when we talk about this anti-faith charge, we should be promoting a faith that is supported by evidence, that we see this throughout the scriptures. We see both God's word and God's works, that both these facets of God's self-revelation will complement each other. They will reinforce each other and ultimately not contradict each other. Francis Bacon says, God has in fact written two books, not just one. Of course, we are all familiar with the first book he wrote, namely Scripture. But he has written a second book called Creation. And we'll get into a little bit more of that as we unpack justification for apologetics. Also, those who think that prayer is that apologetics is somehow in the flesh or it's human self-effort, we're talking about praying as we engage in the apologetic task. It is something that is engaged in independence upon God's Spirit rather than simply going it our own way, going it on our own. So Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, we do not war against the flesh, even though we live in the flesh, that is, as human beings. We are destroying speculation. So even though he's not taking a fleshly approach, notice that he's talking about destroying speculations and everything raised up against the knowledge of God, and we're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. So Paul is certainly not operating by human machinery, by clever arguments and so forth, but he is actually trusting profoundly in the Spirit of God. Let's go on to our third M, some muddles in apologetics. And here I want to unpack a little bit in terms of the some confusions that come. And as we engage with people who are challenging the Christian faith, it might be good to have a handle on some of these categories so that we can respond wisely rather than being led perhaps down some unnecessary rabbit trails. So I want to talk about religion versus worldview. Atheism, which is disbelief, versus agnosticism, which is unbelief. And then I want to talk about culpable versus ignorant, innocent ignorance, and then proof versus good reasons. So these are some areas that need some clarification, given the muddles that come up in the literature and the conversation. So first, let's talk about religion versus worldview. Christopher Hitchens, you may be familiar with this new atheist, no longer with us, but he, in his book, God is Not Great, his subtitle is How Religion Poisons Everything. And this is, of course, a common perception, especially since September 11th, where these new atheists have arisen and written best-selling books, and they have not merely gone against Islam, they have gone against all religion, seeing it as harmful, seeing it as the problem. If we didn't have religion, then how much better would things be? John Lennon, imagine there's no heaven and all that goes along with it. That's the sort of mindset that they have. Well, the problem with that term religion is that it is a very confusing and misguided one. Martin Marty, there he is. A few of us got to meet him in San Diego a couple of years ago. So there he is on the right there. He said that there are at least 17 distinct definitions of religion, and scholars will never agree on the definition of religion. Now, this is kind of curious, isn't it? All this religion bashing, and then there are so many different definitions of religion. I mean, what does religion mean? Does religion mean you believe in God? Well, Buddhists don't believe in God. Believe in miracles. Well, Buddhists don't believe in miracles, Taoists and so forth. You just don't have this kind of uniformity that you could describe every religion in this way, that there's this common core of beliefs or tenets that all these religions hold. You just don't have that. And so it can be very confusing. In fact, I was asked to participate in a debate here at the Oxford Union. And it was supposed to be on whether religion is helpful or harmful. And I emailed back. I said, I'd like to participate in a debate. But the problem is, when you say religion, I want to know what we're talking about. Religion is very vague and unhelpful. And whereas I might hold to a particular, as a Christian, I'll hold to that as a, quote, religion. But a lot of times, so many things get lumped in with religion. And I'm not going to try to defend the Hindu or the Muslim. I want to defend the Christian faith. And so I'd rather speak in terms of maybe whether belief in God is rational or not, rather than, you know, and then defining what we mean and going from there, rather than just religion, this vague, amorphous term. Well, they said, you're right, you've got a good point there, and they said maybe we can get you to speak at the Oxford Union during the Trinity term, but for whatever reason, I didn't hear back from them. So anyway, but there you have it. But that was the point here is that there is so much, there are so many false assumptions when it comes to religion. And one of them is that atheism or secularism is the default position. That, oh, you're religious. Okay, make your point. Prove your case. I'm an atheist or a secularist. I can just stand back and wait for you to unload and because you've got the burden of proof after all. And this, of course, is deeply flawed. That there is, you know, why is that? Because everyone, atheist, theist, etc., has a worldview. And the question is, you know, how do we justify that worldview? You see, even the atheist will take a stance on the nature of reality or metaphysics, on right and wrong, etc., ethics, and knowledge, fundamental pillars within philosophy. How does he justify that stance? Well, you might say, oh, you know, ethics is just a matter of evolutionary development. We're just trying to survive and reproduce and so forth. Okay, well, how do you justify that? How do you know that that somehow excludes God from the picture? Could it not be that these dovetail, perhaps? Or they will say, oh, ethics is just a matter of this subjective feeling that we have, this emotivism. When I say murder is bad, I just mean I don't like murder. But it has no substance beyond what I feel. Well, that's to take a stance on a particular, very important topic. How do you justify it? So you'll often have these sweeping assertions being made, but then we need to press the point and say, well, how do you justify that? The atheist is in no better a position. He bears a burden of proof if he's making a claim. And so we need to be gently pushing back on these sorts of presumptions that we see floating around in the marketplace of ideas. Also, so again, whatever one's worldview, it should be justified rather than simply assumed. Keep in mind, too, that atheism has done its own bit of poisoning. Think of Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot. That are we going to say, oh, therefore, atheism poisons everything? Well, let's talk about the merits of each person's claim. As I also said this, not all traditional religions are created equal. What about the caste system of India or Sharia law in Islam or Hinduism's abusive male deities or whatever? I mean, we can go on down the list. Do I want to lump all that together and try to defend it? No, there are differences between the various religions themselves. As I said, not all traditional religions maintain belief in God to have those tenets aligning themselves to bring all of those various religions together. You just don't have that feature in these religions, the traditional religions. I think it's more illuminating to talk about having a worldview or a philosophy of life rather than the confused, vague dichotomy of religion versus secularism and atheism. No, it's much more textured and nuanced than that, and I think the term religion can be very unhelpful. Even though I'm technically a philosopher of religion, I think it's more helpful to talk about a worldview or philosophy of life. So here's another muddle, and that is when it comes to atheism versus agnosticism. Atheism versus agnosticism. And here we need to understand that atheism is disbelief, not simply a lack of belief in God or the gods. If you claim that atheism is merely unbelief, well, how does that differ from the agnostic, who is also an unbeliever? There is no differentiation. And classically, atheism has held that, Julian Baggini, who's an atheist philosopher himself, says atheism is extremely simple to define. It is the belief that there is no God or gods. Again, this has been the classical definition. Now, when it comes to agnosticism, we need to remember that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's possible that God exists. Even if those arguments don't work, the atheist has to go beyond to show how God cannot exist. I was speaking at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts, and there was this one person who said, the reason I don't believe in God is because the arguments for God don't work. And I said, well, then you should be an agnostic rather than an atheist, because it's possible that even though those arguments don't work, that God could still exist. You have to go beyond that and show whether God does not exist or cannot exist. Not simply that you just have justification for, say, holding off on belief in God or not believing in God. So then the question becomes, what kind of an agnostic are you? And so there is this, so we'll talk about this in just a moment, but agnosticism would be the logical outcome of lack of evidence for belief in God. So if it's evenly weighted, maybe, then you say, well, I'm not sure which way I should go. That's kind of the classical conclusion, but a lot of people will, we need to cash out what we mean by agnosticism. There are two types of agnostic. One we could call the traditional or ordinary agnostic, who says, I'd like to know whether or not God exists, but I can't decide based on the evidence. So that's the ordinary agnostic. Then there is what we could call the militant or ornery agnostic, who says, I don't know whether God exists or not, and you can't know either. Now, it may be that he doesn't know that God exists, but why think that others can't know that God exists? I mean, just because you don't know doesn't mean that no one else could know. Speak for yourself. But yet a lot of people will go beyond what their own personal conclusions are and insist that you can't know either. But notice this knowledge claim creeping in here. They're saying, I know that you can't know. Well, justify that, support that. You may not know, but how can you say that I cannot know? Which brings us to another matter. Even if you're an ordinary, traditional agnostic, there's still the question of your ignorance. If you don't know God exists, well, you can still have a culpable ignorance rather than an innocent ignorance. So, what do we mean by the blameworthy or culpable one? Well, some people may say, oh, I don't know if such is the case, but should they be held responsible for their ignorance? So take, for example, you're driving down the highway, and police officer stops you. The constable in Shepherd's Bush stops you and says, do you know that you were driving over the speed limit? And you say, oh, I didn't really know that. Sorry. Is he going to say, oh, that's okay. You didn't know. You're innocent. Of course not. There is a culpable ignorance. If you're driving out on the road, you ought to take responsibility for watching the signs. So there can be an innocent ignorance. There can also be a culpable ignorance. And then the question becomes, is this agnostic truly paying attention to the evidence that is available, the full range of evidence that is available? And then we come to the question of proof versus good reasons. When we talk about proof, a lot of people will throw this word around, and they will... What they mean by this has to do with some sort of mathematical certainty. And of course, as I said before, there's often this double standard when people want Christians to prove something, but they'll give themselves an excuse. They'll want for the Christian to make the case that God exists, or that the universe that is so finely tuned was created by God. If there's any wiggle room, if they can come up with some sort of, well, it could have happened differently, then they somehow think themselves justified. But when you press them on, well, how could the universe have come into existence uncaused out of nothing? Well, you know, it could have happened this way. And what they will hold against you because they can offer an alternative, when you do the same to them, they will want themselves to be allowed off the hook. They will not hold the bar as high for their own beliefs as they will when they're insisting that you, quote, prove your own beliefs. I think it's helpful to talk about good reasons, which suggests there's a greater plausibility to what I'm holding and that I can have a confident knowledge about it. Doesn't mean that I could be wrong. I could be wrong. It's not as though I have absolute certainty about all of these things. But this raises another question. A lot of people insist that knowledge requires 100% certainty. But how can you prove, for example, with 100% certainty that the universe is older than 15 minutes or that other minds exist? Now, we have good reasons to speak with confidence about that, but again, 100% certainty? No. But should that really bother us? I don't think so. And again, we have to ask the question, why are you so fixated on having 100% certainty? Because that itself presupposes a certain assumption. How can you prove or know with 100% certainty that knowledge requires 100% certainty? You see, there are a lot of things that we know that aren't 100% certain, but we can have confidence in. Now, we can know that the universe is expanding and so forth. Am I 100% sure? No, but that's okay. I don't have to sweat it. We have a high degree of confidence that this is indeed the case. So again, there are some false expectations that people bring to this whole question about God's existence and 100% certainty and so forth. So some muddles there. Well, as I try to wrap up with my fourth point, I'll have to move a fairly quickly here, but stick with me. I'm happy to make this PowerPoint available to you if you're not able to catch all the notes. I'm certainly glad to make that available to you here. But what I'd like to do in this methodology of apologetics is to look at resources we can draw on. For example, naturalistic resources. I'll explain that in a minute. Or aesthetic and literary sources, as well as scientific and historical sources. And then autobiographical sources. This is just a sampling. We could look at a whole range of issues. But what do I mean by the naturalistic sources? And what I mean by naturalism is the belief that the material world is all the reality that there is, that we come to know through the scientific method, that things are determined from the Big Bang until today, that there really is no free will and so forth. But that's what we mean generally by naturalism. And what I often do in presentations that I'm giving on university campuses and so forth is to actually quote a host of naturalists in order to build the case for God's existence. Because in a lot of their, maybe unguarded, open moments where they're confessing about the nature of their naturalism, they often will admit that naturalism has no resources to account for consciousness, to account for moral responsibility, to account for human value and so forth, things that we often take for granted. So let me just give you a sampling here, and you can, I won't say too much more here, but William Rowe, atheist, says it must be acknowledged that the emergence of the Big Bang theory, the origin of the universe, has given new weight to an argument for the existence of some sort of creator. Very interesting. Thank you very much. I'll take that. Part of my arsenal, if you will. Colin McGinn, another naturalist, he says, how can mere matter originate consciousness? How did evolution convert the water of biological tissue into the wine of consciousness? Consciousness seems like a radical novelty in the universe, not prefigured by the after effects of the Big Bang. So how did it contrive to spring into being from what preceded it? Well, the theist says, well, consciousness came from a supremely self-aware being. Consciousness comes from consciousness, not from non-conscious matter. Daniel Dennett, he talks about how humans are like the animals, but he says, but we also have creeds and the ability to transcend our genetic imperatives. This fact makes us different. Sounds kind of like the image of God creeping through here. So this is something that these are the sorts of quotations that I'll find helpful in laying out as I'm making the case for God's existence, citing what the naturalists themselves are saying about, whether they acknowledge it or not, deficiencies or weaknesses in their own worldview. That sounds, again, theism makes a lot more sense of these things than the naturalistic worldview. How about aesthetic or literary sources? Presenting, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien were very good at doing this, presenting the place of beauty and enchantment and imagination in art and literature as a pointer toward the transcendent and a way to recapture our humanity, which has been stripped away by the mechanistic and reductionistic scientism of our day. So, again, I like to quote various people. Holly Ordway, PhD in literature, teaches at Houston Baptist University, says, I found that my favorite writers as an atheist were men and women of deep Christian faith. C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien above all, and then the poets Gerard Manley Hopkins, George Herbert, John Donne, and others. Their work was unsettling to my atheistic convictions. Let them read the classics. Let them see how Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and others go into probing the depths of our own humanity and basically capturing those things that scientism has ignored and bypassed and layered over so that we have lost touch with our very humanity. C.S. Lewis, in reading Chesterton, as in reading MacDonald, George MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. There are traps everywhere. God is, if I may say it, very unscrupulous. So, C.S. Lewis, again, recapturing the imagination, recapturing a vision of the world that had been trampled underfoot by the mechanistic scientism of modernity. Louise Cowan, I really appreciate what she has to say. She came to faith in Christ through reading the classics. She talked about standing at the crossroads, and she said that she had been reared in this Christian belief, which had been seriously damaged during my college years and finally demolished, ironically, by a required course in religion that had brought about my complete capitulation. None of the biblical sources could be considered reliable, the experts of the day argued. And as for me, once the seeds of doubt had been sown, the entire gospel was called into question. When it comes to her return to faith, she says, Before literature came to my aid, I had perused theology in vain. Even the Bible was unconvincing. Not until a literary work of art awakened my imaginative faculties could the possibility of a larger context than reason alone engage my mind. I had been expecting logical proof of something one was intended to recognize. What was needed was a way of seeing. I had to be transformed in the way that literature transforms by story, image, symbol, before I could see the simple truths of the gospel. And she goes on from there to say, above all else, it seems to me that the chief value of what we call the classics, they summon us to belief. They seize our imaginations and make us commit ourselves to the self-evident, which we have forgotten how to recognize. Even for the things ordinarily considered certain, we moderns require proof. In this state of abstraction, we are cut off from the fullness of reality. Something has to reach into our hearts and impel us toward recognition. Literature, the aesthetic realm, beauty, and so forth. Scientific sources, appealing to scientific voices who offer strong support for the mutual illumination of the God-science relationship. So again, I've talked about the Big Bang. Again, these are naturalists here. John Barrow and Joseph Silk. Get this. Our new picture of the universe is more akin to the traditional metaphysical picture of creation out of nothing. For it predicts a definite beginning to events in time, indeed definite beginning to time itself. And when they ask what preceded the event called the Big Bang, they answer, the answer to our question is simple. Nothing. I'd say, it takes quite a bit of faith, a bit of trust to believe that something could come out of nothing when there is not even the potentiality for anything to emerge. Being comes from being rather than non-being. So you say, where did God come from? Well, something always had to be there. Unless you believe that something could pop into existence uncaused out of nothing, something had to be there. You cannot escape it. So you're stuck with that question. Can being come from non-being? No, it cannot. Just metaphysically impossible. Alvin Plantinga, on the fine-tuning of the biofriendliness of the universe, he says, the basic idea that such fine-tuning, again, all these cosmic concepts, things that make life possible. So you've got the beginning of the universe, so the universe exists, you have a universe that is finely tuned for life. But even if you got that doesn't guarantee that life is going to emerge. You've got to have a life-producing universe, not just a life-permitting universe. And then beyond that, you've got to have a life-sustaining universe. Even if life emerges, say, a single-celled organism, what's the guarantee that it's going to continue in existence from, say, a single-celled organism well beyond, say, to Homo sapiens? You see, that's a lot to sustain. If God exists, there's no problem here. But here you've got as Alvin Plantinga says, that such fine-tuning is not at all surprising or improbable on theism. But given atheism, it is surprising. Therefore, theism is to be preferred to atheism. If God exists, these things are not at all problematic. They are indeed probable. Also, comments on biology's apparent teleology, or purposiveness. Here's Francis Crick, an honest man armed, again an atheist, honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which had to have been satisfied to get it going. Some people will say, well, look, you know, we're still working on this origin of life stuff. Well, I think, yeah, go, keep going. And if you can produce life out of non-life, I think it just goes to show you that it takes a lot of intelligent planning to do that. So I think they're just bearing this out. From the Scientific American, every living cell, even the simplest bacterium, teems with molecular contraptions that would be the envy of any nanotechnologist. It's virtually impossible to imagine how a cell's machines could have been formed spontaneously as life first arose. Fascinating. Again, not Christians, you know, atheists, but they're helpful. I appreciate that. Timothy Lenoir from Stanford University says, teleological or design purposive thinking has been steadfastly resisted by modern biology, and yet in nearly every area, research biologists are hard-pressed to find language that does not impute purposiveness to living forms. We talk about computers, the brain being like a computer, the eye being like a camera, or the cell being like a factory or something like that. Again, design language that is being utilized in biology. Even reference to beauty. Scientists like elegance. They like the beauty of a theorem. Like James Clerk Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism. You know, this is something that is, you know, again, a beautiful theorem. But here you have Steven Weinberg, an atheist, saying sometimes nature seems more beautiful than strictly necessary. Why? Well, very interesting to note these admissions. Historical sources. I just again quote a few here. And again, showing that the gospel isn't merely a coherent, intellectually sound, historically grounded belief system, but it is, has made a profound impact where Christians have faithfully lived out the gospel message. So when it comes to democracy or human rights or moral reforms or the founding of modern science, the Christian faith has had a profound impact. So Jürgen Habermas, atheist philosopher, says Christianity has functioned for the normative self-understanding of modernity as more than just a precursor or catalyst. Egalitarian universalism, from which sprang the ideas of freedom and social solidarity, of an autonomous conduct of life and emancipation, the individual morality of conscience, human rights, and democracy, is the direct heir to the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. Atheist, probably the world, you know, the leading, you know, leading philosopher on in the continental Europe. He says, this legacy, substantially unchanged, has been the object of continual critical appropriation and reinterpretation. To this day, there is no alternative to it. And in light of current challenges of post-national constellation, we continue to draw on the substance of this heritage. Everything else is just idle postmodern talk. Here's this atheist saying, folks, the only explanation is the biblical worldview that has shaped our understanding of democracy and human rights and so forth. Jacques Derrida, the same. Today, the cornerstone of international law is the sacred. What is sacred in humanity and so forth? You should not kill. You should not be responsible for a crime against the sacredness. In that sense, the concept of crime against humanity is a Christian concept. Again, atheist Jacques Derrida. And I think there would be no such thing in the law today without the Christian heritage, the Abrahamic heritage, the biblical heritage. We'd also talk about the democratizing gains for humanity through missionaries, Protestant missionaries in particular, conversionary Protestant missionaries. And this is Robert Woodbury, who wrote an award-winning article on this. And he says, the development and spread of religious liberty, mass education, mass printing, volunteer organizations, most major colonial reforms, abolishing slavery, widow burning, foot binding, female circumcision, prepubescent marriage of girls, etc., and the codification of legal protections for non-whites in the 19th and early 20th centuries, these conversionary Protestants were responsible for these remarkable gains. And he says, where Protestant missionaries have had a significant presence in the past are on average more economically developed today with comparatively better health, lower infant mortality, lower corruption, greater literacy, higher educational attainment, especially for women, and more robust membership in non-governmental associations. Rodney Stark talks about, you know, we can go beyond this to talk about the founding of modern science, that the roots of science have rested entirely on religious foundations, and people who brought it about were devout Christians. So we have great historical sources to draw on. In fact, I sent a letter to Rodney Stark at Baylor University. In 2006, he said he was an agnostic. And I wrote to him in 2011 and asked him where he stood in his pilgrimage. And he said, through this study of the impact of the Christian faith in history, he said, I basically wrote myself into the Christian faith. So he identifies himself now as a Christian because he's seen this remarkable impact that the gospel has had. Let me just say something about autobiographical resources, telling the stories of those who have seen the intellectual impact and transformative power of the Christian faith in their own lives. I think this is very important in our day, which appreciates narratives, that appreciates stories. I think it's important to talk about people who have been transformed by the gospel. I think since I'm running out of time, I'll just mention one of these, and this is Brian Stewart of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Let me just read this through for you. And he says this, as someone who started out as someone disillusioned with, quote, religion. He says, I found there is no movement or force closer to the raw truth of war, famines, crises, and the vast human predicament than organized Christianity in action. And there is no alliance more determined and dogged in action than church workers, ordained and lay members, when mobilized for the common good. It is these Christians who are right in the front lines and of committed humanity today, and when I want to find that front, I follow their trail. It is a vast front, stretching from the most impoverished reaches of the developing world to the hectic struggle to preserve caring values in our own towns and cities. I have never been able to reach these front lines without finding Christian volunteers already in the thick of it, mobilizing congregations that care, and being a faithful witness to the truth, the primary light in the darkness, and so often the only light. So this is something that he speaks about in his own, you know, so he talks about how he did not, and I think I somehow cut off part of the quotation here, but he goes on to say from there that he himself did not always take this positive view of religion, but he basically said that he found faith in Christ by visiting those very hell holes of the world, like famine conditions in Ethiopia and so forth, seeing that the Christians were there long before the camera lights had come and long after they had gone. And so it was this that persuaded him of the reality, the gritty reality of the gospel, that is willing to go into these places and bring about light and hope. And so this is what inspired this man who had become so disillusioned with the Christian faith or with religion, quote, religion in general, that brought him back to faith in God. I could quote others like Michael Bird, who speaks of his own experience in encountering the Christ of the Gospels by his own move away from atheism to find the gripping reality of the gospel and how the gospel spoke to his heart. And maybe I'll just give this. Okay, pardon. I got a couple minutes. Okay, yeah. He responds to Bart Ehrman, the skeptic, who basically left, deconverted, after having an education in evangelical institutions, and then left the Christian faith for various reasons. This New Testament critic and scholar, he says, Bart Ehrman's narrative suggests the more educated you are, the less likely you are to believe. My life proves otherwise. I've got my own deconversion story to match his. It says, some have great confidence in skeptical scholarship, and I once did, perhaps more than anyone else. If anyone thinks they're assured in their unbelief, I was more committed. Born of unbelieving parents, never baptized or dedicated, on scholarly credentials, a PhD from a secular university, as to zeal, mocking the church, as to ideological righteousness, totally radicalized. But whatever intellectual superiority I thought I had over Christians, I now counted as sheer ignorance. Indeed, I count everything in my former life as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing the historical Jesus, who is also the risen Lord. For his sake, I have given up trying to be a hipster atheist. I consider that old chestnut pure filth in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him. Not having a CV that will gain me tenure in an Ivy League school, but knowing that I've bound myself to Jesus. And where he is, there I shall also be. He tells about how many years later, after his walk through atheism, he says, I read the New Testament for myself. The Jesus I encountered was far different from the deluded, radical, even mythical character described to me. This Jesus, the Jesus of history, was real. He touched upon things that cut close to my heart, especially as I pondered the meaning of human existence. I was struck by the early church's testimony to Jesus. In Christ's death, God has vanquished evil, and by his resurrection, he has brought life and hope to all. When I crossed from unbelief to belief, all the pieces suddenly began to fit together. I had always felt a strange unease about my disbelief. I had an acute suspicion that there might be something more, something transcendent, but I also knew that I was not told to think that. I knew that ethics was nothing more than aesthetics, a mere word game for things I liked and disliked. I felt conflicted when my heart ached over the injustice and cruelty in the world. Faith grew from seeds of doubt, and I came upon a whole new world that, for the first time, actually made sense to me. To this day, I do not find faith stifling or constricting. Rather, faith has been liberating and transformative for me. It has opened a constellation of meaning, beauty, hope, and life that I had long been indoctrinated to deny. And so began a lifelong quest to know, study, and teach about the one whom Christians call Lord. So those are just, it's a brief overview. I could talk a lot about miracles and so forth, things that have happened in my experience and the experience of others close to me, and well-documented ones at that. But hopefully this overview will be helpful for you as you process how to do apologetics in the marketplace of ideas. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you so much, Paul. And we have about 15 minutes for questions, if anyone has them, and then we'll have a little bit more time to socialize. But yeah, after a talk like that, I'm sure some people have some questions.
Thanks. So one of the things I'm always interested in when I'm doing apologetics is, I guess what I'm trying, not to sell is the wrong word, right? But like what I'm trying to communicate to, on a spectrum, one end, like the merest of mere Christianities, and on the other end, like I'm an evangelical Christian, so like a full-blooded evangelical Christianity. Okay. And one of the things I find like always interesting is, I study philosophy. It's like much easier, right, to recommend to people and to defend a mere Christianity, because you've got less complications that they might try and like have problems with. But I don't know whether you have a view on how to. But also at the same time, I sometimes wonder if actually you're kind of. You're doing them a disservice by really pushing a case for mere Christianity, when actually this kind of thick, full-blooded thing is what really I think is truly wonderful about Christianity. It's the really rich picture of what's going on. There's a natural tendency to do the mere Christianity side because it's easier. But I don't know whether you have reflections from your experience of, I guess it depends on the person you're speaking to, right? But on how. Yeah. To think about the spectrum.
Okay, so the question is, for the recording here, what should we defend, mere Christianity or perhaps something more robust? Are we taking a shortcut in defending mere Christianity rather than something more robust and full-bodied? Well, I would say defending mere Christianity is very robust and full-bodied. C.S. Lewis, as you look at his book, Mere Christianity, I mean, you look at that, it is a very rich, textured, well-argued work. And I think it's also constructive because it avoids a kind of sectarianism that has so often characterized Christianity in the minds of so many people. And I think the more you can do to present a more coherent, unified picture without getting sidetracked onto the more sectarian or denominational issues that may divide Christians, I think we actually may be setting up a stumbling block for people by recommending more than what the gospel requires us to recommend to people. So I would say that we ought to be a bit more restrained, and I like to quote Lee Iacocca, the Chrysler Corporation CEO, former CEO, who said, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And I think this is very wise for us as we engage in defending the gospel, proclaiming the gospel, that we avoid, I think, some of those more narrow pathways, as rich and helpful as they may be, in order to really focus on what the gospel is. I think sometimes, you know, we probably have encountered, I don't know where you all are coming from in terms of theology, but I have encountered many who take a very strongly Calvinistic view, and they will equate that with the gospel. And they, I think, are doing a disservice to the cause of Christ, to the witness in the marketplace of ideas, because if people say, oh, I can't accept that understanding of the, you know, the Christian faith, well, they're treating it as that's the only alternative and that's the only game in town. And we just, I think, just have to be more, a bit more measured about these things. So thank you for your question.
I know I have two questions, but I don't want to jump on other people's chance. But okay, Ruta, go ahead.
I sort of have a follow-up question. I'm not sure if I will form it well, but you mentioned that one of the things of methodologies is science, and I find a lot of apologetics cling on to science. But from the history perspective, you know, clinging on to science brought Christianity's sort of like dishonor. What I mean is, like, when they killed the guy, Copernicus, and all the people were saying,
Galileo, put him on trial.
And now we're clinging on to Big Bang, saying, yes, that's the proof of God. And then, I don't know, 100 years later, they will say, well, it's not. And then, so I guess my question is that how you balance that sort of scientific side and not to, I don't know,
overreach.
Yes, yeah. I guess that would be the thing. Because I guess for a lot of people, proofs is like facts, right?
Right.
So science is not like, you know, as you said, 100%. Proving
sure,
things.
Sure, yeah. It's a probabilistic undertaking,
exactly.
For sure, yeah.
So I don't know if that's a good formulation of question.
No, appreciate it. How do we, you know, if science maybe is changing or people latch on to one, perhaps one proponent of this particular view and then find that it all comes crashing down and we need to revise things and we need to, our attempt to align the Christian faith with science really didn't prove all that helpful or maybe even was harmful. Where do we draw some of these lines? So that's a great question. I think, again, trying to keep the main thing the main thing. We, for example, Alvin Plantinga said the problem is not when it comes to evolution and creation. He said the problem is not, you know, evolution versus creation, but God versus no God. The problem is not evolution per se, but unguided evolution. That really would be a very strong dividing line. So I think picking our battles well, and I think that when it comes to, of course, Galileo himself was very, I think, clumsy in how he did things, very political in how he did things. So in Copernicus, I know that Luther took issue with him and so forth. But there were many others who did find this new way of looking at the universe illuminating and so forth. But I'd say that you want to, I think, consider those things that have been better tested, better explained over the long haul, rather than just kind of latching on to the latest theory, something like the second law of thermodynamics. The universe is winding down. I think this actually points us in the direction of something beyond the universe, something that wound the universe up, as it were, so that, you know, because the universe is winding down. So finally, the things, you know, broad agreement, the Big Bang theory, so, you know, the universe is expanding and so forth, that it has every, that second law of thermodynamics, the expansion of the universe, the microwave background radiation of the universe, that these point to the finitude or the origination of the universe a finite time ago. So I think looking for those kind of steady reinforcements over the decades and even now century or more, where we have this kind of a reinforcement of these sorts of themes, rather than latching on to, I think, some of the, again, part of this has to do with hermeneutics too, and how people approach the scriptures. Like, a lot of people place a lot of stock in the scriptures as a scientific textbook, whereas that simply was not how the original author intended for it to be understood. It was more literary and theological rather than some sort of a scientific textbook, as a lot of Christians, unfortunately, will treat it. So there's doing some homework on that front as well that is also going to be required that will give, I think, greater illumination. So I think there's also just the need for being a bit more patient and not being quick to jump on a certain bandwagon, like there's now a question about the historical Adam and so forth. And I think just being patient, waiting how, you know, just recently read about how, oh, humanity actually may have begun in Europe rather than in Africa. You see, this is how these conversations often go. And I think just being very careful about simply latching onto something in a very dogmatic way, letting things play out, being a bit more tentative, I think is a wise course of going about things.
Paul, your talk was entitled The Gospel, the Marketplace of Ideas. And I think much of what you were taking on in this talk was sort of the new atheist kind of dogmatic naturalism sort of approach. Could you talk about, is there anything else out there in that marketplace of ideas that you find to be a challenger, if you will, to sort of Christian way of seeing things? Is there anything else that you find yourself often engaged with apologetics against?
Are you thinking, okay, the question is, are there
worldviews?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are certain worldviews that may have a certain appeal to them. The question is, are there any worldviews that seem to issue a very strong challenge to the Christian faith, where, you know, there's a real tussle going on? And I suppose in some ways the problem of evil, however it's being addressed, I mean, I think often naturalists or atheists, humanists, will bring up the problem of evil, not so much a worldview, but a certain issue that I think is, at which I think Christians will feel especially vulnerable. And, you know, again, it's the leading argument against the Christian faith, I would say. I would question that, however, because even if you're dealing with the problem of evil, the critic himself is going to have to come to terms with, how do I address the problem of evil in my own worldview? I can challenge the Christian, but how do I make sense of it in my own worldview? I mean, C.S. Lewis, as an atheist, he found that God seemed highly implausible because the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But then as he thought about it, where did I get this idea of just and unjust? He said, it's basically, you can't call something crooked unless you have an idea of what straight is. And here he was using this measure of justice to decide or to render God impossible, but yet, if you remove God from the picture, the matter only becomes worse. I've been in email correspondence with someone who says, I'm basically giving up on God. How could God allow all these things? I said, well, what are you going to go to? If you get rid of God, when it comes to the problem of evil, one, you're getting rid of any sort of standard or design plan from which evil is a deviation. So how do you even make sense of the very existence of evil? It's sort of like having counterfeit money. How do you make sense of counterfeit money unless you've got the real currency? Secondly, if you get rid of God because of evil, you get rid of the very hope for the human condition because of a God who steps into this world, who gets his feet dirty and hands bloody in order to redeem humankind. You see, this world isn't the final story. There is a world that is going to come that has been prepared through the cross and resurrection of Jesus, a new creation that is guaranteed by virtue of his resurrection that we can share in, that there is going to be an end to pain, there's going to be an end to sorrow and so forth. So if you get rid of God, you're getting rid of that solution to the problem of evil. If you get rid of God, you're also getting rid of any possibility of cosmic justice. In the end, Hitler, Pol Pot, Stalin, etc., all of these will have gotten away with murder millions of times over. But if there is a God, he will make sure that justice is, you know, that justice is meted out, that all things will be set right in the end. And then just a final point, God guarantees that there will be a coming together of virtue and happiness. You know, ultimate happiness is something that we're designed for. In your presence is fullness of joy. Your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore, Psalm 16 says. But if there is no God, then those people like Mother Teresa, people who have, you know, worked hard, you know, virtuously and so forth, they will never see the reward of their, you know, their labors for God and so forth. It will all be for naught. But if God exists, then he will guarantee that those who have fought for the right thing, who have given themselves to him, that they will see ultimate happiness in the end. So again, without God, that longing for ultimate happiness that C.S. Lewis talks about, again, totally becomes an impossibility. Yet we long for something more than what we have in this life. But again, the problem of evil, it is a big problem, but every worldview has to deal with it. But if you get rid of God, it only makes those matters worse. So I'd say that that's the fundamental issue that I keep on coming up with. And I could add this too. I mean, I talk about the question of the Canaanites, and I write about that in the book. That's another big issue that often comes up. But I think that that's really a secondary one to really the more fundamental problem of evil that I've just kind of laid out a response to.
Thanks for your talk.
Thank you.
So my own experience, I read the most apologetic sort of point as a university student when I was under kind of going through doubt. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, and as you talk and write with people, do you feel like how much is apologetics something Christian to talk to non-Christians? How much is it something that we use to deal with our own doubts and insecurities or questions?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, I do touch on that in the book. A little book for new philosophers, they have a whole chapter on doubt. But I think, one, when we're dealing with doubt, it's helpful to note the species of doubt that do exist. That it's not just intellectual doubt that exists. There is, yes, intellectual doubt, which we respond to with intellectual arguments and reasons and evidence and so forth. But there can be people who have emotional doubts. I think for whatever the lapses or gaps in their particular backgrounds, some certain deficiencies, maybe father or mother issues and so forth, that they have certain insecurities that need to be addressed. I find that those who keep on saying, yes, but what if, or isn't it possible that, no matter how much evidence you give them, they'll always be second-guessing or saying what if. I think that there's more to it than just the issue of answers to their objections. There's, I think, something deeper, an emotional kind of doubt that needs to be addressed. So that's another type. There's also, I think, moral doubt. Doubt that comes through disobedience, that comes through wanting to do my own thing. C.S. Lewis said a person who is maybe... a guy who sees an attractive woman, or he's finding that he could take some shortcuts at work to get some more money. Then he says, I've been thinking lately, as though this gives rise to doubts. And it's not so much intellectual, but now these moral issues have created maybe a certain pathway that he can go to perhaps rationalize away belief in God because of that accountability factor. You can also have spiritual, there's spiritual warfare issues too. We can talk about that. So I'd say there is a range of doubts that we can be talking about, and so different ways to address them. But I do think that doubt can be very helpful, doubt can be a stepping stone to strengthening our own faith, that as we are wrestling with certain issues and really grappling very hard and finding ourselves as we work through them much stronger, much better prepared, better grounded, we will have something to carry us through those storms with even greater, a greater wherewithal. But when it comes to, I think, times of kind of ease, if you will, Jeremy Taylor talked about, this Puritan writer, talked about dealing with our, kind of coming up with the foundations of our faith, understanding what the foundations of our faith are, reasons for believing in Jesus Christ, coming to terms with those before we actually go into those deep seas of doubt, so that we'll be better prepared, we'll have a better understanding of what our faith is all about. We'll understand those reasons rather than just easily jettisoning our faith when these doubts assail us. So different ways of understanding the question of doubt, approaching the issue of doubt, but ultimately it can be a stepping stone to having our own faith strengthened, and apologetics can be very useful in that. So thanks.
Okay. Well, I think we're about out of time, so if you have any more questions, maybe we could save them for a little break afterwards. But just let's give Paul one more round of applause.
Thank you.